No fear, answered Pelias. Would you like to see how fortune holds with Strabonus?
Blue fire burned in Conan's eyes, and he gripped his sword until his knuckles showed blue.
Oh, to be at sword points with him, he rumbled.
Pelias lifted a great shimmering globe from an ebony table.
Sotha's crystal. A childish toy, but useful when there is lack of time for higher science. Look in, your majesty.
He laid it on the table before Conan's eyes. The king looked into cloudy depths, which deepened and expanded. Slowly, images crystallized out of mist and shadows. He was looking on a familiar landscape. Broad plains ran to a wide, winding river, beyond which the level lands ran up quickly into a maze of low hills. On the northern bank of the river stood a walled town, guarded by a moat connected at each end with the river.
By Crom! Ejaculated Conan. It's Shamar! The dogs besiege it!
The invaders had crossed the river. Their pavilions stood in the narrow plain between the city and the hills. Their warriors swarmed about the walls, their mail gleaming palely under the moon. Arrows and stones rained on them from the towers, and they staggered back, but came on again. Even as Conan cursed, the scene changed. Tall spires and gleaming domes stood up in the mist, and he looked on his own capital of Tamar, where all was confusion. He saw the steel-clad knights of Poitain, his staunchest supporters, riding out of the gate, hooted and hissed by the multitude which swarmed the streets. He saw looting and rioting, and men-at-arms whose shields bore the insignia of Pelia, manning the towers and swaggering through the markets. Over all, like a phantasmal mirage, he saw the dark, triumphant face of Prince Arpello of Pelia. The images faded.
So, raved Conan, my people turn on me the moment my back is turned.
Not entirely, broke in Pelias.
They have heard that you are dead. There is no one to protect them from outer enemies and civil war, they think. Naturally, they turn to the strongest noble to avoid the horrors of anarchy. They do not trust the Poitanians, remembering former wars. But Arpello is on hand, and the strongest prince of the central provinces.
When I come to Aquilonia again, he will be but a headless corpse rotting on Traitor's Common.
Conan ground his teeth.
Yet before you can reach your capital, reminded Pelias, Strabonus may be before you. At least his riders will be ravaging your kingdom.
True.
Conan paced the chamber like a caged lion.
With the fastest horse, I could not reach Shamar before midday. Even there, I could do no good except to die with the people when the town falls. As fall it will in a few days at most. From Shamar to Tamar is 5 days' ride, even if you kill your horses on the road. Before I could reach my capital and raise an army, Strabonus would be hammering at the gates. Because raising an army is going to be hell, all my damnable nobles would have scattered to their own cursed fiefs at the word of my death. And since the people have driven out Trocero of Poitain, there's none to keep Arpello's greedy hands off the crown, and the crown treasure. He'll hand the country over to Strabonus in return for a mock throne, and as soon as Strabonus's back is turned, he'll stir up revolt. But the nobles won't support him, and it will only give Strabonus excuse for annexing the kingdom openly.
Oh, Crom, Emir, and Set!
If I but had wings to fly like lightning to Tamar!
Pelias, who sat tapping the jade tabletop with his fingernails, halted suddenly, and rose as with a definite purpose, beckoning Conan to follow. The king complied, sunk in moody thoughts, and Pelias led the way out of the chamber and up a flight of marble, gold-worked stairs that led out on the pinnacle of the citadel. the roof of the tallest tower. It was night, and a strong wind was blowing through the star-filled skies, stirring Conan's black mane. Far below them twinkled the lights of Korshamesh, seemingly farther away than the stars above them. Pelias seemed withdrawn and aloof here, one in cold, unhuman greatness with the company of the stars.
"There are creatures," said Pelias, "not alone of earth and sea, but of air and the far reaches of the skies as well, dwelling apart, unguessed of men. Yet to him who holds the master words and signs, and the knowledge underlying all, they are not malignant nor inaccessible. Watch and fear not."
He lifted his hands to the skies and sounded a long, weird call that seemed to shudder endlessly out into space, dwindling and fading, yet never dying out, only receding farther and farther into some unreckoned cosmos. In the silence that followed, Conan heard a sudden beat of wings in the stars, and recoiled as a huge bat-like creature alighted beside him. He saw its great calm eyes regarding him in the starlight. He saw the 40-foot spread of its giant wings, and he saw it was neither bat nor bird.
"Mount and ride," said Pelias. "By dawn it will bring you to Tamar." "By Crom," muttered Conan, "is this all a nightmare from which I shall presently awaken in my palace at Tamar? What of you? I would not leave you alone among your enemies."
"Be at ease regarding me," answered Pelias. "At dawn the people of Korshamesh will know they have a new master. Doubt not what the gods have sent you. I will meet you in the plain by Shamar."
Doubtfully, Conan clambered upon the ridged back, gripping the arched neck, still convinced that he was in the grasp of a fantastic nightmare. With a great rush and thunder of titan wings, the creature took the air, and the king grew dizzy as he saw the lights of the city dwindle far below him. 4. The sword that slays the king cuts the cords of the empire. Aquilonian proverb. The streets of Tamar swarmed with howling mobs, shaking fists and rusty pikes. It was the hour before dawn of the second day after the Battle of Shamu, and events had occurred so swiftly as to daze the mind. By means known only to Tsothalantai, word had reached Tamar of the king's death, within half a dozen hours after the battle. Chaos had resulted. The barons had deserted the royal capital, galloping away to secure their castles against marauding neighbors. The well-knit kingdom Conan had built up seemed tottering on the edge of dissolution, and commoners and merchants trembled at the imminence of a return of the feudalistic regime. The people howled for a king to protect them against their own aristocracy, no less than foreign foes. Count Trocero, left by Conan in charge of the city, tried to reassure them, but in their unreasoning terror they remembered old civil wars, and how this same count had besieged Tamar 15 years before. It was shouted in the streets that Trocero had betrayed the king, that he planned to plunder the city. The mercenaries began looting the quarters, dragging forth screaming merchants and terrified women. Trocero swept down on the looters, littered the streets with their corpses, drove them back into their quarter in confusion, and arrested their leaders. Still the people rushed wildly about, with brainless squawks, screaming that the count had incited the riot for his own purposes. Prince Arpello came before the distracted council and announced himself ready to take over the government of the city until a new king could be decided upon, Conan having no son. While they debated, his agents stole subtly among the people, who snatched at a shred of royalty. The council heard the storm outside the palace windows, where the multitude roared for Arpello the Rescuer. The council surrendered.
Trocero at first refused the order to give up his baton of authority, but the people swarmed about him, hissing and howling, hurling stones and offal at his knights. Seeing the futility of a pitched battle in the streets with Arpello's retainers under such conditions, Trocero hurled the baton in his rival's face, hanged the leaders of the mercenaries in the market square as his last official act, and rode out of the southern gate at the head of his 1,500 steel-clad knights. The gates slammed behind him, and Arpello's suave mask fell away to reveal the grim visage of the hungry wolf. With the mercenaries cut to pieces or hiding in their barracks, his were the only soldiers in Tamar. Sitting his war horse in the great square, Arpello proclaimed himself King of Aquilonia, amid the clamor of the deluded multitude. Publius the Chancellor, who opposed this move, was thrown into prison. The merchants, who had greeted the proclamation of a king with relief, now found with consternation that the new monarch's first act was to levy a staggering tax on them. Six rich merchants, sent as a delegation of protest, were seized and their heads slashed off without ceremony. A shocked and stunned silence followed this execution. The merchants, confronted by a power they could not control with money, fell on their fat bellies and licked their oppressors' boots. The common people were not perturbed at the fate of the merchants, but they began to murmur when they found that the swaggering Pelian soldiery, pretending to maintain order, were as bad as Turanian bandits. Complaints of extortion, murder, and rape poured into Arpello, who had taken up his quarters in Publius's palace, because the desperate counselors, doomed by his order, were holding the royal palace against his soldiers. He had taken possession of the pleasure palace, however, and Conan's girls were dragged to his quarters. The people muttered at the sight of the royal beauties writhing in the brutal hands of the iron-clad retainers. Dark-eyed damsels of Poitain, slim black-haired wenches from Zamora, Zingara, and Hyrcania, Brythunian girls with tousled yellow heads, all weeping with fright and shame, unused to brutality. Night fell on a city of bewilderment and turmoil, and before midnight, word spread mysteriously in the streets that the Cothians had followed up their victory and were hammering at the walls of Shamar. Somebody in Tsatha's mysterious secret service had babbled. Fear shook the people like an earthquake, and they did not even pause to wonder at the witchcraft by which the news had been so swiftly transmitted. They stormed at Arpello's doors, demanding that he march southward and drive the enemy back over the Tibur. He might have subtly pointed out that his force was not sufficient, and that he could not raise an army until the barons recognized his claim to the crown. But he was drunk with power, and laughed in their faces. A young student, Ephemedes, mounted a column in the market and with burning words accused Arpello of being a cat's paw for Strabonus, painting a vivid picture of existence under Cothian rule with Arpello as satrap. Before he finished, the multitude was screaming with fear and howling with rage. Arpello sent his soldiers to arrest the youth, but the people caught him up and fled with him, deluging the pursuing retainers with stones and dead cats. A volley of crossbow quarrels routed the mob, and a charge of horsemen littered the market with bodies. But Ephemedes was smuggled out of the city to plead with Trocero to retake Tamar and march to aid Shamar. Ephemedes found Trocero breaking his camp outside the walls, ready to march to Poitain in the far southwestern corner of the kingdom. To the youth's urgent pleas, he answered that he had neither the force necessary to storm Tamar, even with the aid of the mob inside, nor to face Strabonus. Besides, avaricious nobles would plunder Poitain behind his back while he was fighting the Cothians. With the king dead, each man must protect his own. He was riding to Poitain, there to defend it as best he might against Arpello and his foreign allies. While Ephemedes pleaded with Trocero, the mob still raved in the city with helpless fury. Under the great tower beside the royal palace, the people swirled and milled, screaming their hate at Arpello, who stood on the turrets and laughed down at them while his archers ranged the parapets, bolts drawn and fingers on the triggers of their arbalests. The Prince of Pelia was a broad-built man of medium height, with a dark, stern face. He was an intriguer, but he was also a fighter. Under his silken jupon, with its gilt-braided skirts and jagged sleeves, glimmered burnished steel. His long black hair was curled and scented, and bound back with a cloth of silver band. But at his hip hung a broadsword, the jeweled hilt of which was worn with battles and campaigns.
"Fools! Howl as you will! Conan is dead, and Arpello is king!"
What if all Aquilonia were leagued against him? He had men enough to hold the mighty walls until Strabonus came up, but Aquilonia was divided against itself. Already the barons were girding themselves, each to seize his neighbor's treasure. Arpello had only the helpless mob to deal with. Strabonus would carve through the loose lines of the warring barons as a galley ram through foam, and until his coming, Arpello had only to hold the royal capital.
"Fools! Arpello is king!"
The sun was rising over the eastern towers. Out of the crimson dawn came a flying speck that grew to a bat, then to an eagle. Then all who saw screamed in amazement, for over the walls of Tamar swooped a shape such as men knew only in half-forgotten legends, and from between its titan wings sprang a human form as it roared over the great tower. Then, with a deafening thunder of wings, it was gone, and the folk blinked, wondering if they dreamed. But on the turret stood a wild, barbaric figure, half-naked, blood-stained, brandishing a great sword. And from the multitude rose a roar that rocked the towers.
"The king! It is the king!"
Arpello stood transfixed. Then with a cry he drew and leaped at Conan. With a lion-like roar, the Cimmerian parried the whistling blade, then, dropping his own sword, gripped the prince and heaved him high above his head by crotch and neck.
"Take your plots to hell with you!"
he roared. And like a sack of salt, he hurled the Prince of Pelia far out, to fall through empty space for 150 feet. The people gave back as the body came hurtling down, to smash on the marble pave, spattering blood and brains, and lie crushed in its splintered armor like a mangled beetle. The archers on the tower shrank back, their nerve broken. They fled, and the beleaguered councilmen sallied from the palace and hewed into them with joyous abandon. Pelian knights and men-at-arms sought safety in the streets, and the crowd tore them to pieces. In the streets, the fighting milled and eddied, plumed helmets and steel caps tossed among the tussled heads, and then vanished. Swords hacked madly in a heaving forest of pikes, and over all rose the roar of the mob, shouts of acclaim mingling with screams of bloodlust and howls of agony. And high above all, the naked figure of the king rocked and swayed on the dizzy battlements, mighty arms brandished, roaring with gargantuan laughter that mocked all mobs and princes, even himself. 5. A long bow and a strong bow, and let the sky grow dark. The cord to the knock, the shaft to the ear, and the king of Koth for a mark. Song of the Bossonian Archers. The mid-afternoon sun glinted on the placid waters of the Tibor, washing the southern bastions of Shamar. The haggard defenders knew that few of them would see that sun rise again. The pavilions of the besiegers dotted the plain. The people of Shamar had not been able successfully to dispute the crossing of the river, outnumbered as they were. Barges, chained together, made a bridge over which the invader poured his hordes. Strabonus had not dared march on into Aquilonia with Shamar, unsubdued, at his back. He had sent his light riders, his spahis, inland to ravage the country, and had reared up his siege engines in the plain. He had anchored a flotilla of boats, furnished him by Amalrus, in the middle of the stream, over against the river wall. Some of these boats had been sunk by stones from the city's ballistas, which crashed through their decks and ripped out their planking. But the rest held their places, and from their bows and mastheads, protected by mantlets, archers raked the riverward turrets. These were Shemites, born with bows in their hands, not to be matched by Aquilonian archers. On the landward side, mangonels rained boulders and tree trunks among the defenders, shattering through roofs and crushing humans like beetles. Rams pounded incessantly at the stones. Sappers burrowed like moles in the earth, sinking their mines beneath the towers. The moat had been dammed at the upper end and emptied of its water, had been filled up with boulders, earth, and dead horses and men. Under the walls, the mailed figures swarmed, battering at the gates, rearing up scaling ladders, pushing storming towers thronged with spearmen against the turrets. Hope had been abandoned in the city, where a bare 1,500 men resisted 40,000 warriors. No word had come from the kingdom whose outpost the city was. Conan was dead, so the invaders shouted exultantly. Only the strong walls and the desperate courage of the defenders had kept them so long at bay, and that could not suffice forever. The western wall was a mass of rubbish on which the defenders stumbled in hand-to-hand conflict with the invaders. The other walls were buckling from the mines beneath them, the towers leaning drunkenly. Now the attackers were massing for a storm. The olifants sounded. The steel-clad ranks drew up on the plain. The storming towers, covered with raw bullhides, rumbled forward. The people of Shamar saw the banners of Koth and Ophir flying side by side in the center, and made out, among their gleaming knights, the slim, lethal figure of the golden-mailed Amalrus, and the squat, black-armored form of Strabonus. And between them was a shape that made the bravest blench with horror, a lean vulture figure in a filmy robe. The pikemen moved forward, flowing over the ground like the glinting waves of a river of molten steel. The knights cantered forward, lances lifted, guidons streaming. The warriors on the walls drew a long breath, consigned their souls to Mitra, and gripped their notched and red-stained weapons. Then, without warning, a bugle call cut the din. A drum of hoofs rose above the rumble of the approaching host. North of the plain across which the army moved rose ranges of low hills, mounting northward and westward like giant stair steps. Now, down out of these hills, like spume blown before a storm, shot the Spahis who had been laying waste the countryside, riding low and spurring hard. And behind them, sun shimmered on moving ranks of steel. They moved into full view, out of the defiles. Mailed horsemen, the great lion banner of Aquilonia floating over them. From the electrified watchers on the towers, a great shout rent the skies. In ecstasy, warriors clashed their notched swords on their riven shields, and the people of the town, ragged beggars and rich merchants, harlots in red kirtles and dames in silks and satins fell to their knees and cried out for joy to Mitra, tears of gratitude streaming down their faces. Strabonus, frantically shouting orders with Arbanus that would wheel around the ponderous lines to meet this unexpected menace, grunted, "We still outnumber them, unless they have reserves hidden in the hills. The men on the battle towers can mask any sorties from the city. These are Portanians. We might have guessed Trocero would try some such mad gallantry." Amalrus cried out in unbelief.
"I see Trocero and his captain Prospero. But who rides between them?" "Ishtar, preserve us!" shrieked Strabonus, paling. It is King Conan!
You are mad, squalled Sotha, starting convulsively. Conan has been in Satha's belly for days.
He stopped short, glaring wildly at the host which was dropping down, file by file, into the plain. He could not mistake the giant figure in black, gilt-worked armor on the great black stallion, riding beneath the billowing silken folds of the great banner. A scream of feline fury burst from Tsotha's lips, flecking his beard with foam. For the first time in his life, Strabonus saw the wizard completely upset and shrank from the sight.
"Here is sorcery!"
screamed Tsotha, clawing madly at his beard.
"How could he have escaped and reached his kingdom in time to return with an army so quickly? This is the work of Pelias, curse him! I feel his hand in this!
May I be cursed for not killing him when I had the power!"
The kings gaped at the mention of a man they believed 10 years dead, and panic, emanating from the leaders, shook the host. All recognized the rider on the black stallion. Tsotha felt the superstitious dread of his men, and fury made a hellish mask of his face.
"Strike home!"
he screamed, brandishing his lean arms madly.
"We are still the stronger! Charge and crush these dogs! We shall yet feast in the ruins of Shamar tonight! Oh, Set!"
He lifted his hands and invoked the serpent god to even Strabonus's horror.
"Grant us victory, and I swear I will offer up to thee 500 virgins of Shamar, writhing in their blood!"
Meanwhile, the opposing host had debauched onto the plain. With the knights came what seemed a second irregular army on tough, swift ponies. These dismounted and formed their ranks, on foot. Stolid Bossonian archers and keen pikemen from Gunderland, their tawny locks blowing from under their steel caps. It was a motley army Conan had assembled in the wild hours following his return to his capital. He had beaten the frothing mob away from the Pelian soldiers who held the outer walls of Tamar and impressed them into his service. He had sent a swift rider after Trocero to bring him back. With these as a nucleus of an army, he had raced southward, sweeping the countryside for recruits and for mounts. Nobles of Tamar and the surrounding countryside had augmented his forces, and he had levied recruits from every village and castle along his road. Yet it was but a paltry force he had gathered to dash against the invading hosts, though of the quality of tempered steel. 1,900 armored horsemen followed him, the main bulk of which consisted of the Poitanian knights. The remnants of the mercenaries and professional soldiers in the trains of loyal noblemen made up his infantry. 5,000 archers and 4,000 pikemen. This host now came on in good order. First the archers, then the pikemen, behind them the knights, moving at a walk. Over against them, Arbanus ordered his lines, and the allied army moved forward like a shimmering ocean of steel. The watchers on the city walls shook to see that vast host, which overshadowed the powers of the rescuers. First marched the Shemitish archers, then the Kothian spearmen, then the mailed knights of Strabonus and Amalrus. Arbanus's intent was obvious, to employ his footmen to sweep away the infantry of Conan and open the way for an overpowering charge of his heavy cavalry. The Shemites opened fire at 500 yards, and arrows flew like hail between the hosts, darkening the sun. The western archers, trained by 1,000 years of merciless warfare with the Pictish savages, came stolidly on, closing their ranks as their comrades fell. They were far outnumbered, and the Shemitish bow had the longer range, but in accuracy, the Bossonians were equal to their foes, and they balanced sheer skill in archery by superiority in morale and in excellency of armor. Within good range they loosed, and the Shemites went down by whole ranks. The blue-bearded warriors in their light mail shirts could not endure punishment as could the heavier armored Bosonians. They broke, throwing away their bows, and their flight disordered the ranks of the Kothian spearmen behind them. Without the support of the archers, these men-at-arms fell by the hundreds before the shafts of the Bosonians, and charging madly into close quarters, they were met by the spears of the pikemen. No infantry was a match for the wild Gundermen, whose homeland, the northernmost province of Aquilonia, was but a day's ride across the Bosonian marchers from the borders of Cimmeria, and who, born and bred to battle, were the purest blood of all the Hyborian peoples. The Kothian spearmen, dazed by their losses from arrows, were cut to pieces and fell back in disorder. Strabonus roared in fury as he saw his infantry repulsed and shouted for a general charge. Arbanus demurred, pointing out the Bosonians reforming in good order before the Aquilonian knights, who had sat their steeds motionless during the melee. The general advised a temporary retirement to draw the western knights out of the cover of the bows, but Strabonus was mad with rage. He looked at the long, shimmering ranks of his knights. He glared at the handful of mailed figures over against him, and he commanded Arbanus to give the order to charge. The general commended his soul to Ishtar and sounded the golden olifant. With a thunderous roar, the forest of lances dipped, and the great host rolled across the plain, gaining momentum as it came. The whole plain shook to the rumbling avalanche of hoofs, and the shimmer of gold and steel dazzled the watchers on the towers of Shamar. The squadrons clave the loose ranks of the spearmen, riding down friend and foe alike, and rushed into the teeth of a blast of arrows from the Bosonians. Across the plain they thundered, grimly riding the storm that scattered their way with gleaming knights like autumn leaves. Another 100 paces they would ride among the Bosonians and cut them down like corn. But flesh and blood could not endure the rain of death that now ripped and howled among them. Shoulder to shoulder, feet braced wide, stood the archers, drawing shaft to ear and loosing as one man with deep, short shouts. The whole front rank of the knights melted away, and over the pin-cushioned corpses of horses and riders, their comrades stumbled and fell headlong. Arbanus was down, an arrow through his throat, his skull smashed by the hoofs of his dying warhorse, and confusion ran through the disordered host. Strabonus was screaming an order, Amalrus another, and through all ran the superstitious dread the sight of Conan had awakened. And, while the gleaming ranks milled in confusion, the trumpets of Conan sounded, and through the opening ranks of the archers crashed the terrible charge of the Aquilonian knights. The hosts met with a shock like that of an earthquake that shook the tottering towers of Shamar. The disorganized squadrons of the invaders could not withstand the solid steel wedge, bristling with spears that rushed like a thunderbolt against them. The long lances of the attackers ripped their ranks to pieces, and into the heart of their host rode the knights of Poitain, swinging their terrible two-handed swords. The clash and clangor of steel was as that of a million sledges on as many anvils. The watchers on the walls were stunned and deafened by the thunder as they gripped the battlements and watched the steel maelstrom swirl and eddy, where plumes tossed high among the flashing swords and standards dipped and reeled. Amalrus went down, dying beneath the trampling hoofs, his shoulder bone hewn in twain by Prospero's two-handed sword. The invaders' numbers had engulfed the 1900 knights of Conan, but about this compact wedge, which hewed deeper and deeper into the looser formation of their foes, the knights of Koth and Ophir swirled and smote in vain. They could not break the wedge. Archers and pikemen, having disposed of the Kothian infantry, which was strewn in flight across the plain, came to the edges of the fight, loosing their arrows point-blank, running in to slash at girths and horses' bellies with their knives, thrusting upward to spit the riders on their long pikes. At the tip of the steel wedge, Conan roared his heathen battle cry and swung his great sword and glittering arcs that made not of steel burgonet or mail habergeon. Straight through a thundering waste of foes he rode, and the knights of Koth closed in behind him, cutting him off from his warriors. As a thunderbolt strikes, Conan struck, hurtling through the ranks by sheer power and velocity until he came to Strabonus, livid among his palace troops. Now here the battle hung in balance. For with his superior numbers, Strabonus still had opportunity to pluck victory from the knees of the gods. But he screamed when he saw his arch foe within arm's length at last, and lashed out wildly with his axe. It clanged on Conan's helmet, striking fire, and the Cimmerian reeled and struck back. The 5-foot blade crushed Strabonus's casque and skull, and the king's charger reared, screaming, hurling a limp and sprawling corpse from the saddle. A great cry went up from the host, which faltered and gave back. Trocero and his house troops, hewing desperately, cut their way to Conan's side, and the great banner of Koth went down. Then, behind the dazed and stricken invaders, went up a mighty clamor and the blaze of a huge conflagration. The defenders of Shamar had made a desperate sortie, cut down the men masking the gates, and were raging among the tents of the besiegers, cutting down the camp followers, burning the pavilions, and destroying the siege engines. It was the last straw. The gleaming army melted away in flight, and the furious conquerors cut them down as they ran. The fugitives raced for the river, but the men on the flotilla, harried sorely by the stones and shafts of the revived citizens, cast loose and pulled for the southern shore, leaving their comrades to their fate. Of these, many gained the shore, racing across the barges that served as a bridge, until the men of Shamar cut these adrift and severed them from the shore. Then the fight became a slaughter. Driven into the river to drown in their armor, or hacked down along the bank, the invaders perished by the thousands. No quarter had they promised. No quarter they got. From the foot of the low hills to the shores of the Tibor, the plain was littered with corpses, and the river, whose tide ran red, floated thick with the dead. Of the 1,900 knights who had ridden south with Conan, scarcely 500 lived to boast of their scars, and the slaughter among the archers and pikemen was ghastly. But the great and shining host of Strabonus and Amalrus was hacked out of existence, and those that fled were less than those that died. While the slaughter yet went on along the river, the final act of a grim drama was being played out in the meadowland beyond. Among those who had crossed the barge bridge before it was destroyed was Tsotha, riding like the wind on a gaunt, weird-looking steed whose stride no natural horse could match. Ruthlessly riding down friend and foe, he gained the southern bank, and then a glance backward showed him a grim figure on a great black stallion in pursuit. The lashings had already been cut, and the barges were drifting apart, but Conan came recklessly on, leaping his steed from boat to boat as a man might leap from one cake of floating ice to another. Tsotha screamed a curse, but the great stallion took the last leap with a straining groan and gained the southern bank. Then the wizard fled away into the empty meadowland, and on his trail came the king, riding hard, swinging the great sword that splattered his trail with crimson drops. On they fled, the hunted and the hunter, and not a foot could the black stallion gain, though he strained each nerve and thew. Through a sunset land of dim and elusive shadows they fled, till sight and sound of the slaughter died out behind them. Then in the sky appeared a dot, that grew into a huge eagle as it approached. Swooping down from the sky, it drove at the head of Tsotha's steed, which screamed and reared, throwing its rider. Old Tsotha rose and faced his pursuer, his eyes those of a maddened serpent, his face an inhuman mask. In each hand he held something that shimmered, and Conan knew he held death there. The king dismounted and strode toward his foe, his armor clanking, his great sword gripped high.
"Again we meet, wizard," he grinned savagely.
"Keep off!" screamed Tsotha, like a blood-mad jackal. "I'll blast the flesh from your bones. You cannot conquer me. If you hack me in pieces, the bits of flesh and bone will reunite and haunt you in your doom. I see the hand of Pelias in this. But I defy ye both. I am Tsotha, son of—"
Conan rushed, sword gleaming, eyes slits of wariness. Tsotha's right hand came back and forward, and the king ducked quickly. Something passed by his helmeted head and exploded behind him, searing the very sands with a flash of hellish fire. Before Tsotha could toss the globe in his left hand, Conan's sword sheared through his lean neck. The wizard's head shot from his shoulders on an arching fount of blood, and the robed figure staggered and crumpled drunkenly. Yet the mad black eyes glared up at Conan with no dimming of their feral light. The lips writhed awful, and the hands groped as if searching for the severed head. Then, with a swift rush of wings, something swooped from the sky. The eagle which had attacked Tsotha's horse. In its mighty talons it snatched up the dripping head and soared skyward, and Conan stood struck dumb. For from the eagle's throat boomed human laughter in the voice of Pelias the sorcerer. Then a hideous thing came to pass. For the headless body reared up from the sand and staggered away in awful flight on stiffening legs, hands blindly outstretched toward the dot, speeding and dwindling in the dusky sky. Conan stood like one turned to stone, watching until the swift, reeling figure faded in the dusk that purpled the meadows.
"Crom!"
His mighty shoulders twitched.
"A murrain on these wizardly feuds. Pelias has dealt well with me, but I care not if I see him no more. Give me a clean sword and a clean foe to flesh it in. Damnation! What would I not give for a flagon of wine?"
Queen of the Black Coast. 1. Conan joins the pirates. Believe green buds awaken in the spring, that autumn paints the leaves with somber fire. Believe I held my heart inviolate, to lavish on one man my hot desire. The Song of Baylit. Hoofs drummed down the street that sloped to the wharfs. The folk that yelled and scattered had only a fleeting glimpse of a mailed figure on a black stallion, a wide scarlet cloak flowing out on the wind. Far up the street came the shout and clatter of pursuit, but the horseman did not look back. He swept out onto the wharfs and jerked the plunging stallion back on its haunches at the very lip of the pier. Seamen gaped up at him as they stood to the sweep and striped sail of a high-prowed, broad-waisted galley. The master, sturdy and black-bearded, stood in the bows, easing her away from the piles with a boat-hook. He yelled angrily as the horseman sprang from the saddle and with a long leap landed squarely on the mid-deck.
"Who invited you aboard?"
"Get underway!"
roared the intruder, with a fierce gesture that spattered red drops from his broadsword.
"But we're bound for the coasts of Kush,"
expostulated the master.
"Then I'm for Kush. Push off, I tell you."
The other cast a quick glance up the street, along which a squad of horsemen were galloping. Far behind them toiled a group of archers, crossbows on their shoulders.
"Can you pay for your passage?" demanded the master.
"I pay my way with steel,"
roared the man in armor, brandishing the great sword that glittered bluely in the sun.
"By Crom, man! If you don't get underway, I'll drench this galley in the blood of its crew!"
The shipmaster was a good judge of men. One glance at the dark, scarred face of the swordsman hardened with passion, and he shouted a quick order, thrusting strongly against the piles. The galley wallowed out into clear water. The oars began to clack rhythmically. Then a puff of wind filled the shimmering sail. The light ship heeled to the gust, then took her course like a swan, gathering headway as she skimmed along. On the wharfs, the riders were shaking their swords and shouting threats and commands that the ship put about, and yelling for the bowmen to hasten before the craft was out of arbalest range.
"Let them rave," grinned the swordsman hardly. "Do you keep her on her course, Master Steersman?"
The master descended from the small deck between the bows, made his way between the rows of oarsmen, and mounted the mid-deck. The stranger stood there with his back to the mast, eyes narrowed alertly, sword ready. The shipman eyed him steadily, careful not to make any move toward the long knife in his belt. He saw a tall, powerfully built figure in a black scale-mail hauberk, burnished greaves, and a blue steel helmet from which jutted bull's horns, highly polished. From the mailed shoulders fell the scarlet cloak, blowing in the sea wind. A broad shagreen belt with a golden buckle held the scabbard of the broadsword he bore. Under the horned helmet, a square-cut black mane contrasted with smoldering blue eyes.
"If we must travel together," said the master, "we may as well be at peace with each other. My name is Tito, licensed master shipman of the ports of Argos. I am bound for Kush, to trade beads and silks and sugar and brass-hilted swords to the Black Kings for ivory, copra, copper ore, slaves, and pearls."
The swordsman glanced back at the rapidly receding docks, where the figures still gesticulated helplessly, evidently having trouble in finding a boat swift enough to overhaul the fast-sailing galley.
"I am Conan, a Cimmerian," he answered. "I came into Argos seeking employment, but with no wars forward, there was nothing to which I might turn my hand."
"Why do the guardsmen pursue you?" asked Tito. "Not that it's any of my business, but I thought perhaps—"
"I've nothing to conceal," replied the Cimmerian. "By Crom, though I've spent considerable time among you civilized peoples, your ways are still beyond my comprehension. Well, last night in a tavern, a captain in the king's guard offered violence to the sweetheart of a young soldier, who naturally ran him through. But it seems there is some cursed law against killing guardsmen, and the boy and his girl fled away. It was bruited about that I was seen with them, and so today I was haled into court, and a judge asked me where the lad had gone. I replied that since he was a friend of mine, I could not betray him. Then the court waxed wroth, and the judge talked a great deal about my duty to the state, and society, and other things I did not understand, and bade me tell where my friend had flown. By this time I was becoming wrathful myself, for I had explained my position. But I choked my ire and held my peace, and the judge squalled that I had shown contempt for the court, and that I should be hurled into a dungeon to rot until I betrayed my friend. So then, seeing they were all mad, I drew my sword and cleft the judge's skull. Then I cut my way out of the court, and seeing the high constable's stallion tied nearby, I rode for the wharfs, where I thought to find a ship bound for foreign parts."
"Well," said Tito heartily, "the courts have fleeced me too often in suits with rich merchants for me to owe them any love. I'll have questions to answer if I ever anchor in that port again, but I can prove I acted under compulsion. You may as well put up your sword.
We're peaceable sailors and have nothing against you. Besides, it's as well to have a fighting man like yourself on board. Come up to the poop deck, and we'll have a tankard of ale.
Good enough, readily responded the Cimmerian, sheathing his sword.
The Argus was a small, sturdy ship, typical of those trading craft which ply between the ports of Zingara and Argos and the southern coasts, hugging the shoreline and seldom venturing far into the open ocean. It was high of stern, with a tall, curving prow, broad in the waist, sloping beautifully to stem and stern. It was guided by the long sweep from the poop, and propulsion was furnished mainly by the broad-striped silk sail, aided by a jibsail. The oars were for use in tacking out of creeks and bays, and during calms. There were 10 to the side, 5 fore and 5 aft of the small mid-deck. The most precious part of the cargo was lashed under this deck and under the foredeck. The men slept on deck or between the rowers' benches, protected in bad weather by canopies. With 20 men at the oars, 3 at the sweep, and the shipmaster, the crew was complete. So the Argus pushed steadily southward with consistently fair weather. The sun beat down from day to day with fiercer heat, and the canopies were run up. Striped silken cloths that matched the shimmering sail and the shining gold work on the prow and along the gunwales. They sighted the coast of Shem, long rolling meadowlands with the white crowns of the towers of cities in the distance, and horsemen with blue-black beards and hooked noses who sat their steeds along the shore and eyed the galley with suspicion. She did not put in. There was scant profit in trade with the sons of Shem. Nor did Master Tito pull into the broad bay where the Styx River emptied its gigantic flood into the ocean, and the massive black castles of Kamai loomed over the blue waters. Ships did not put unasked into this port, where dusky sorcerers wove awful spells in the murk of sacrificial smoke mounting eternally from blood-stained altars where naked women screamed, and where Set, the old serpent, archdemon of the Hyborians but god of the Stygians, was said to writhe his shining coils among his worshippers. Master Tito gave that dreamy, glass-floored bay a wide berth. Even when a serpent-prowed gondola shot from behind a castellated point of land, and naked, dusky women with great red blossoms in their hair stood and called to his sailors, and posed and postured brazenly. Now, no more shining towers rose inland. They had passed the southern borders of Stygia and were cruising along the coasts of Cush. The sea and the ways of the sea were never-ending mysteries to Conan, whose homeland was among the high hills of the northern uplands. The wanderer was no less of interest to the sturdy seamen, few of whom had ever seen one of his race. They were characteristic Argosian sailors, short and stockily built. Conan towered above them, and no two of them could match his strength. They were hardy and robust, but his was the endurance and vitality of a wolf, his thews steeled and his nerves whetted by the hardness of his life in the world's wastelands. He was quick to laugh, quick and terrible in his wrath. He was a valiant trencherman, and strong drink was a passion and a weakness with him. Naive as a child in many ways, unfamiliar with the sophistry of civilization, he was naturally intelligent, jealous of his rights, and dangerous as a hungry tiger. Young in years, he was hardened in warfare and wandering, and his sojourns in many lands were evident in his apparel. His horned helmet was such as was worn by the golden-haired Aesir of Nordheim. His hauberk and greaves were of the finest workmanship of Koth. The fine ringmail which sheathed his arms and legs was of Nemedia, and the blade at his girdle was a great Aquilonian broadsword, and his gorgeous scarlet cloak could have been spun nowhere but in Ophir. So they beat southward, and Master Tito began to look for the high-walled villages of the black people. But they found only smoking ruins on the shore of a bay,
littered with naked black bodies. Tito swore.
I had good trade here aforetime. This is the work of pirates.
And if we meet them? Conan loosened his great blade in its scabbard.
Mine is no warship. We run, not fight. Yet if it came to a pinch, we have beaten off Reavers before and might do it again, unless it were Belit's Tigress.
Who is Belit?
The wildest she-devil unhanged. Unless I read the signs are wrong, it was her butchers who destroyed that village on the bay. May I someday see her dangling from the yardarm. She is called the Queen of the Black Coast. She is a Shemite woman who leads black raiders. They harry the shipping and have sent many a good tradesman to the bottom.
From under the poop deck, Tito brought out quilted jerkins, steel caps, bows, and arrows.
Little use to resist if we're run down, he grunted, but it rasps the soul to give up life without a struggle.
It was just at sunrise when the lookout shouted a warning. Around the long point of an island off the starboard bow glided a long, lethal shape, a slender, serpentine galley with a raised deck that ran from stem to stern. 40 oars on each side drove her swiftly through the water, and the low rail swarmed with naked blacks that chanted and clashed spears on oval shields. From the masthead floated a long, crimson pennon.
Belit!
Yelled Tito, paling.
Yare! Put her about! Into that creek mouth! If we can beach her before they run us down, we have a chance to escape with our lives!
So, veering sharply, the Argus ran for the line of surf that boomed along the palm-fringed shore. Tito striding back and forth, exhorting the panting rowers to greater efforts. The master's black beard bristled. His eyes glared.
"Give me a bow," requested Conan. "It's not my idea of a manly weapon, but I learned archery among the Hyrcanians, and it will go hard if I can't feather a man or so on yonder deck."
Standing on the poop, he watched the serpent-like ship skimming lightly over the waters, and landsman though he was, it was evident to him that the Argus would never win that race. Already arrows, arching from the pirate's deck, were falling with a hiss into the sea, not 20 paces astern.
"We'd best stand to it," growled the Cimmerian, "else we'll all die with shafts in our backs, and not a blow dealt."
"Bend to it, dogs!"
roared Tito with a passionate gesture of his brawny fist. The bearded rowers grunted, heaved at the oars, while their muscles coiled and knotted, and sweat started out on their hides. The timbers of the stout little galley creaked and groaned as the men fairly ripped her through the water. The wind had fallen. The sail hung limp. Nearer crept the inexorable raiders, and they were still a good mile from the surf when one of the steersmen fell gagging across the sweep, a long arrow through his neck. Tito sprang to take his place, and Conan, bracing his feet wide on the heaving poop deck, lifted his bow. He could see the details of the pirate plainly now. The rowers were protected by a line of raised mantelets along the sides, but the warriors dancing on the narrow deck were in full view. These were painted and plumed, and mostly naked, brandishing spears and spotted shields. On the raised platform in the bows stood a slim figure whose white skin glistened in dazzling contrast to the glossy ebon hides about it. Belit, without a doubt. Conan drew the shaft to his ear. Then some whim or qualm stayed his hand and sent the arrow through the body of a tall plumed spearman beside her. Hand over hand, the pirate galley was overhauling the lighter ship. Arrows fell in a rain about the Argus, and men cried out. All the steersmen were down, pin-cushioned, and Tito was handling the massive sweep alone, gasping black curses, his braced legs knots of straining thews. Then, with a sob, he sank down, a long shaft quivering in his sturdy heart. The Argus lost headway and rolled in the swell.
The men shouted in confusion, and Conan took command in characteristic fashion.
"Up, lads!"
he roared, loosing with a vicious twang of cord.
"Grab your steel and give these dogs a few knocks before they cut our throats. Useless to bend your backs any more. They'll board us ere we can row another 50 paces.
In desperation, the sailors abandoned their oars and snatched up their weapons. It was valiant, but useless. They had time for one flight of arrows before the pirate was upon them. With no one at the sweep, the Argus rolled broadside, and the steel-beaked prow of the raider crashed into her amidships. Grappling irons crunched into the side. From the lofty gunwales, the black pirates drove down a volley of shafts that tore through the quilted jackets of the doomed sailormen, then sprang down spear in hand to complete the slaughter. On the deck of the pirate lay half a dozen bodies, an earnest of Conan's archery. The fight on the Argus was short and bloody. The stocky sailors, no match for the tall barbarians, were cut down to a man. Elsewhere, the battle had taken a peculiar turn. Conan, on the high-pitched poop, was on a level with the pirate's deck. As the steel prow slashed into the Argus, he braced himself and kept his feet under the shock, casting away his bow. A tall corsair, bounding over the rail, was met in midair by the Cimmerian's great sword, which sheared him cleanly through the torso, so that his body fell one way and his legs another. Then, with a burst of fury that left a heap of mangled corpses along the gunwales, Conan was over the rail and on the deck of the Tigress. In an instant he was the center of a hurricane of stabbing spears and lashing clubs, but he moved in a blinding blur of steel. Spears bent on his armor or swished empty air, and his sword sang its death song. The fighting madness of his race was upon him, and with a red mist of unreasoning fury wavering before his blazing eyes, he cleft skulls, smashed breasts, severed limbs, ripped out entrails, and littered the deck like a shambles with a ghastly harvest of brains and blood. Invulnerable in his armor, his back against the mast, he heaped mangled corpses at his feet until his enemies gave back, panting in rage and fear. Then, as they lifted their spears to cast them, and he tensed himself to leap and die in the midst of them, a shrill cry froze the lifted arms. They stood like statues, the black giants poised for the spear casts, the mailed swordsman with his dripping blade. Baylit sprang before the blacks, beating down their spears. She turned toward Conan, her bosom heaving, her eyes flashing. Fierce fingers of wonder caught at his heart. She was slender, yet formed like a goddess, at once lithe and voluptuous. Her only garment was a broad silken girdle. Her white ivory limbs and the ivory globes of her breasts drove a beat of fierce passion through the Cimmerian's pulse, even in the panting fury of battle. Her rich black hair, black as a Stygian night, fell in rippling burnished clusters down her supple back. Her dark eyes burned on the Cimmerian. She was untamed as a desert wind, supple and dangerous as a she-panther. She came close to him, heedless of his great blade, dripping with the blood of her